Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us today. We begin today's show with a conversation about life, society, and ants. Biologist and theorist E.O. Wilson has examined the social life of these insects to develop his thinking about humans interact and the nature of evolution. He's been called the father of scientific humanism, and he joined me in the studio a few years ago when his book, The Social Conquest of Earth, was published. Let's take a listen. Let's begin with ants, bees, termites, and wasps. These are EU societies. Help us understand what they can tell us about ourselves.
Let's assume that some of this will be unfamiliar anyway to the audience. And EU means agreeable, gentle, whatever, but it also means real. So we say eusocial for real, which means that it's that level of social behavior which is characterized by cooperation based upon altruistic behavior among the individual, some of whom are willing to give up a little bit of their lifespan or the amount of reproduction they do. This has occurred, by my count, some 24 times in the history of life. It's a very rare occurrence. It does occur in some insects, ants, bees, wasps, termites, but also in some marine crustaceans and a few other examples of evolution of social behavior in the animal kingdom as a whole. Now, in taking these into account, and surprisingly, this hasn't been done hardly at all with reference to humans because of the perception we have that humans are so elevated, you know, up to demigod status, that we don't bear description with animals. And yet, we do use lower organisms to understand ourselves.
Well, as you say, even at the very beginning of your book, we struggle to see our connection to apes, much less our connection to bees, wasps, termites, and what you have just been talking about.
Well, that's true, but consider that the lowly E. coli, which is that bacterium in your gut, was used to get the major understandings we have had on a great deal of molecular genetics of human beings, and that a little roundworms called Caenorhabditis were the animal creatures used to understand how nervous systems are put together. So what I have done is to go to lower organisms to see what really caused the rise of eusociality, and it fits together very well.
Well, let me just pick up on that, because what you're talking about are traits that have helped maybe a nest or a community. So there's cooperation, there's the divvying up of work, and there's also this ability to communicate, whether it's you know, through chemicals or the way you and I are talking with each other.
That's right. And most of creatures in the world, including most of these insects, it's all chemical.
And that's how they talk with each other. But that's what we share. So we cooperate, we work together, and we communicate in one form or another.
Yes,
these are you society.
Most importantly, we have the vision of labor based on altruism.
Right. Yeah. Now, going back, then, this is where I guess you have broken with not just yourself but also with other people, the idea that kin selection was our way of understanding not just human evolution, but also altruism, why people would self-sacrifice for the good of their gene pool.
That's right, their immediate relatives. Actually, the idea was that if you have a group of kin, close kin together, then you've created the conditions under which eusociality can arise. Because if you were to sacrifice yourself a little bit, you know, to cooperate with kin and give up a little, and the kin benefited by more than a compensating amount by through the increase of the genes that you share with the kin by your common ancestry. You know, you're still, if you're brother, sister, you have half your genes shared. That then that's the way altruism would arise, and that's the way societies could form, with enough aggregation and enough of that occurring. So kin selection, I just said what it was, was seen for a long time as the key to the whole thing. It didn't really explain that much, but it was there was a faith that this was what we would eventually use to explain everything. But after 40 years, and I was one of the first promoters.
I know you were.
It just was spinning its wheels, and it was not working very well, and there were a lot of things against it. So thus I came, and others came back to, not so much back, but we renewed a whole different approach that had been jettisoned, and that would include evolution to an advanced degree by group versus group, group selection. If you're in a group and you cooperate in that group and you're altruistic in that group, then that group can defeat other groups, even though it's made up of selfish individuals. That's the basic idea.
Well, maybe we could take a workplace. I mean, here we are where I work. We're part of a group. We have – everyone has largely different roles, but nonetheless, the mission is the thing that draws us all together. Yeah. Are we an example of a you society?
Well, in a lesser and more diffuse sense.
Right.
In that you belong to other groups as well. But there are primary groups of affiliation that you have actually you could put the term tribe on. Humanity is divided into tribes. They're fluctuating. Mm-hmm. They're dividing. They're growing with alliances. They're growing by coercion, and they're growing especially around the world by common religious faith, and by that I mean they share the same creation story. And those who have the same creation story believe in general that they also, therefore, through their leaders, have the voice of God and the direction and the favor of God. And that's the source of a lot of trouble. But that's probably the best illustration of tribal divisions in modern human life.
Well, something that you wrote here, I'm quoting from your book, a group selection shapes instincts that tend to make individuals altruistic toward one another, but not towards members of other groups. Individual selection is responsible for much of what we call sin, while group selection is responsible for the great part of virtue. Together, they have created the conflict between the poor and better angels of our nature. You're saying, in a sense, human beings have warring instincts.
This is what's really new about the renewal of this more complex theory of, you know, two levels of natural selection, group versus group, tending to engender cooperation and altruistic behavior. And many of the things that we consider to be morally superior and hard to understand versus the competition that goes on in the old-fashioned Darwinian state within groups. The fact is that we are a kind of chimera.
Meaning?
We have genes that predispose us to the one, and we're shaped by the evolution occurring at the individual level, versus genes that were engendered by group selection that predispose us to the other. So where are we? We are conflicted as a species. We're caught in between. If we went in one direction all the way to individual level selection, the society would dissolve. If we went all the other way to complete cooperation and complete and altruism, then we would be sort of robotic angels. We would be like ants, actually. So the human
doing our job.
Well, the human condition then is to be conflicted in this manner. An important lesson to be learned, if this is correct, and I think it is the correct view of the human condition, is that we are wasting our time if we think that there is an ideal political system, religion, ideology, economic system. We just sort of have to snuffle our way on through history.
Well, that's so depressing. I mean, but doesn't evolution say that we get better over time, that we improve the species over time?
We're unique in that we have that high intelligence.
We do.
That allows us to complicate and elaborate individual interactions within the group and also between groups to the point where, no, We will never go to one extreme or the other.
So we're caught between these competing forces in a way, sure, evolutionary forces?
But that's what makes us both creative and interesting. I mean, if you think about it, the humanities, including fiction, the creative arts, are born out of that conflict. The humanities work within a rather narrow field of elaborations, endless permutations on interrelations among individuals that really interest us because they are in that conflict area.
Let me quote something from the very beginning of your book, page one. You write, "We have created a Star Wars civilization with Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. We thrash about. We're terribly confused by the mere fact of our existence and a danger to ourselves and to the rest of life."
That sums it up.
That's a pretty, I'm not sure if that's a pessimistic, but a gritty view of human beings.
It shouldn't be, because so much of human creativity comes out of that ferment, including ambition, the right kind of ambition, the intense desire to do something new, to find something better, to express our own feelings, to express the group feelings. If we were really unified by a single ideology, mm-hmm. if we really went the direction of extreme cooperation, that is, we were designed only by group selection, then we would be a pretty dull species.
That was my conversation with biologist E.O. Wilson, who joined me in 2012 to discuss his updated theory of evolution, which he documented in his book, The Social Conquest of Earth. You're listening to Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with author Mary Roach about life in space. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The U.S. and Russia don't cooperate much these days, but when it comes to space travel and exploration, the two countries have found some common ground. Currently, a Russian and an American are spending a year in space to test the effect that life in orbit has on the human body. We got a glimpse of what living in space is like and how these bold explorers prepare for such an expedition when author Mary Roach was our guest. She unpacked the human side of space travel with her trademark humor in her book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Let's take a listen. As a kid growing up, were you one of those kids that was either interested in being an astronaut or was curious about space travel, things like that?
Surprisingly, you would think that I would have been. I was 10 years old when the lunar landing happened, and I don't remember. Somehow the whole thing escaped me.
How about now? I mean, now do you feel that sense of sort of awe and curiosity?
I'm the kind of person that loves, I don't get NASA TV because our cable package doesn't include it, but when you're at Johnson Space Center, the hotel across the street, the first cable channel is NASA TV. I just sit and watch it because some of it's raw feed. It's just the space station and somebody will drift into view and then they'll do a press conference, and they look sort of normal. They're all lined up, and then you see somebody's necklace floating in front of their face. And I love watching that stuff.
Now, you've tried out zero gravity, yes?
Yes, I was on the what NASA used to, well, they never called it the Vomit Comet. They like to call it the Weightless Wonder. It's a C-9 airplane that flies in these roller coaster up and down arcs, and you have about 22 seconds when the plane is coming down where you're weightless. And it's just the most fabulous experience I've ever had. It was really because you're just hanging there in air. Your organs have no weight, nothing, no part of you has any weight, and it's sort of this liberating, sort of a physical euphoria almost. And they give you good drugs so you don't get sick.
Well, and I have several questions here. So it was just a couple. I mean, like 22 seconds of feeling, and even for that very short period of time, it feels that different.
It's 22 seconds, but there's 30 parabolas where you're going up and over and down. And then when the plane comes down to the bottom and goes back up, then you're in double gravity, which is also very strange, but not as pleasant.
Because you're being pressed down.
Yeah,
right?
you weigh twice what you would weigh on the ground. Right. So you actually can't pick your head up off the floor, which is a very strange. I mean, I think you probably could if you have very strong neck muscles, but I don't. So but yes, just in 22 seconds, you just, and you can fly across the plane like Superman. You just like stretch out and float across. It's fabulous.
And I know that you wrote about for astronauts. I don't know whether you can experience this on that sort of up and down of weightlessness, the kind of rapture of what it's like when you're an astronaut taking off into space, and I guess leaving space behind, but also that experience of weightlessness as well.
Well, I think, you know what's the most amazing thing to me, having experienced weightlessness in these little bursts, like sort of euphoric 20-second bursts, and wanting to do it again, astronauts will tell you that after the first few days, zero gravity actually becomes really annoying because you put things down. You can't put anything down. It floats away. You know, you've brought up, say, one nail file, and you put it down, and it's gone. And the rest of the mission, you can't file your nails. Your hands float up and kind of knock you in the head. And just this, it's, they say, God, it'd just be great to be able to walk across the room.
Yeah.
I think, wow, really? You don't like it anymore?
Because it does take away things like wrinkles, right? At least temporarily.
Someone was telling me about she called it the space beauty treatment because in zero gravity, more of your body fluid is in the upper half of your body. So normally gravity would pull it down to your legs. So there's more of that fluid, so it plumps up your wrinkles. And also your organs float up under your rib cage a little bit, so your waist is smaller. Your boobs float. There's no sagging. Nothing sags.
I guess more complicated than something like Botox, but perhaps some of the same effect.
Some of the same effect, yes. So, but then I've also heard it called puffy face chicken leg syndrome. So I'm not exactly sure.
So do you have renewed respect for gravity, having experienced a gravitylessness?
Well, I do, just in that you don't really realize how, even in terms of something as simple as a fuse, you know, a fuse works, you know, this little piece of metal turns molten and drips away and breaks the current. Well, that it doesn't drip in zero gravity, so just everything will overheat. And then the heat just sticks, you know, doesn't dissipate, it doesn't rise, so things tend to overheat. I mean, the engineering challenges are unbelievable. And so, yeah, gravity is a challenge in ways I could never, ever have imagined. Just you name it, it has to be rethought. And all the basic skills, I mean, astronauts are these incredibly high-achieving, top-of-their-class people, but they basically go back to preschool. They need to learn how to eat, how to cross the room, how to go to the bathroom. Everything gets relearned. Yeah.
Well, your book talks a lot about going to the bathroom. And in
part, definitive chapter.
In part, what interested me, and I have great respect for kind of 6th and 7th grade or playground questions, because they are the questions that kids want to know, and frankly, I think adults do as well.
And Mary Roach wants to know.
And Mary Roach wants to, and that's why we depend on you to do the research for us. But technology speak, I mean, this is an issue that NASA and other parts of the space exploration industry had to try to figure out, which is, how do you go to the bathroom in space?
Yeah, because in the early days, when it was the capsules, and Mercury, it was such a short flight, it didn't matter. But Gemini and Apollo, and this is a tiny space. There was no toilet, and it was really essentially for number two. You just had a bag, and it was the single most debilitating factor in terms of morale. There's this wonderful quote. I don't know who said it, but there was a meeting where the astronauts were giving feedback and telling their horror stories about the fecal bags, and there was somebody who at the meeting who just listened for a while and then said, we have to do better.
And they do.
And
do
they, now they have these toilets that look like a washing machine, very complicated. They don't, you need gravity, actually. I won't go into the details, but gravity is what, you know, makes the material disappear down into the toilet. And so you have to use another technique. So that's airflow, and it's also a much smaller hole, and it's a hole very complex. Plus, you have to test this toilet. Big old thing. You got to haul it over to Ellington Field. It rides the same plane that I was on. that up and down roller coaster zero gravity plane, and they need to test it. That means somebody has to, on command in 22 seconds, ready, go. And sometimes they can't.
Because we're talking about zero gravity here, right?
Right, right. So they've got it. They've got to see, does the toilet work in zero gravity? Mm-hmm. And because if you fly it up there and go, yeah, I think it'll probably be okay, and then it's not, that's a very expensive failure. So they do actually have to test it. They can use simulants, too.
Well, while we're on the subject, and I posted this on Facebook, we have to get into something called fecal popcorning. And what is that, Mary Roach?
Okay. Well, the shuttle toilet... It kind of freeze dries the material, and it's airflow. So kind of imagine an air popcorn popper. There can, little pieces tend to sort of bounce around because the material gets hardened because it's exposed to the vacuum of space. So you have little things bouncing around, and it's zero gravity. So that bouncing around they call fecal popcorning. And the danger is that you can have what's called an escapee, which is as the astronaut is getting up, one of the little pieces before the slider valve goes across will escape. And then you have this little floating piece of matter that you don't want in the spacecraft with you. So that is fecal popcorning.
And
since you asked.
And we'll just do a couple more questions here, but also a guy named Sherwin Gormley.
Gormley, yes.
Known as the Urine King. And he solved another part of the problem of space travel.
Yes, Sherwin Gormley worked on the rig that recycles urine. And because he's at NASA Ames, and that's a think tank. That's where they're really looking at theoretical problems way off in the future. A Mars mission. Imagine you've got very little, you don't want to be blasting off all this weight. The weight of the water, the food, the fuel would really, you couldn't get a rocket powerful enough to launch you away from the Earth's gravitational field if you're carrying everything that you needed. So they do this very extreme recycling. Your sweat, urine, that is recycled into drinking water. And I sat down with Sherwin Gormley, and we had lunch at NASA Ames in the cafeteria, and we both had recycled a glass of urine. Just, and it is, my husband was horrified because I stored it overnight in the refrigerator, and he was disgusted, and I guess I don't blame him. But it tasted very sweet because you need to get the salt out of the urine. It's sort of this, it's called osmotic pressure. And so you end up with this, it's very sugary water, like something you would feed hummingbirds.
Oh, interesting. So you drank your own filtered urine?
Yes, I did.
And lived
and
to tell
so did Sherwin. Yes,
and so
lived
it.
Right. And so did it, yeah.
But what's interesting is it's not just this stuff, because I don't think it's silly. This is about how you survive in space. And if you're going to Mars, you have to solve some of these basic problems.
Right. And also, this is going on like in Orange County. There's this whole, no toilet to tap, and people are very uncomfortable with that. But in fact, the technology exists to do it very easily, to remove the impurities and to create drinking water that doesn't have any bad taste. I mean, it's a controversial thing, but he was saying, this is something we've been doing, for years, and it's a psychological issue more than anything else.
Which also tells us that there is this trickle down that comes from the kind of technology experimentation that goes into space travel.
Oh, right. One of the things, it's hard to justify the cost of a Mars mission, and I understand that. But when you look at some of the innovations that have come out of NASA, and it is quite extraordinary. Anything that's fireproof, cordless, lightweight, automated, miniaturized, you can sort of be not sure, but it's likely that NASA had a hand in that technology. And high-speed wireless data transfer, sports bras, firefighters' masks, solar panels. There's a lot of technology that, because it's all thinking outside the box to try to get human beings to the moon or to Mars.
So to this hostile environment.
Yeah, this place for which you're just not at all equipped. So this amazing innovation goes on, and it would be a shame to lose that.
Hmm. There are many other things to talk about, but you mentioned the fact that the motion sickness, nausea. I think anyone that's had a bumpy ride in an airplane or been in swells in a boat knows about how you feel, and trying to imagine oneself living in outer space or moving into outer space, nausea is a problem.
Space motion sickness is a serious problem, and it's one that in the early days, up through Apollo, the astronauts didn't talk about it. They tried to hide it because it was sort of wasn't a macho thing to be sick to your tummy, but it is a serious and debilitating thing. I remember one of the astronauts in his memoir said, I didn't want them to think I was some nugget on a summer cruise. You know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so Rusty Schweikert was the first astronaut to really go public and talk about it. And then go over to Pensacola there in Florida. There's a research unit, and he was involved in a lot of the research. The research is fascinating because in order to study motion sickness, you've got to be good at creating it in a laboratory setting. So they have these torture devices like the rotating chair, which I sat in one at NASA.
Describe it.
Basically, like an office chair that pushed and just you're spinning around in circles in your office chair, and then you turn your head to the left and you touch your cheek to the side of there's like a little pad on either side, to the right, to the left, and as you're spinning, and what's going on is you have these little floating sort of calcifications in the inner ear. And that's what makes you sick. I mean, it's a conflict between the little floating bones and what your eyeballs are telling you. So it's sort of they can't get their stories straight. And in space, since those little calcifications are floating instead of settling down to the bottom, it's very disorienting. It takes a while to, a few days to get adapted to it. That's why you don't see like spacewalks during the first couple of days, because it's possible that the astronaut is over in the corner in the fetal position. If
just
you can do that, feeling quite sick. And plus, in space in zero gravity, you have this thing called the visual reorientation illusion, which is when you look up and you thought you were in one orientation, and then you see somebody upside down, and it just does a number on you.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And you feel very suddenly very sick, and it comes on very quick. And, of course, if you're not prepared in zero gravity, that's a floating mess that you've got to chase down, and very unpleasant.
So do they have drugs for this, or are they just helping astronauts acclimate to these alien environments?
There are drugs, and when I flew on the zero gravity flight, of course, it was something because I'm just a one-time for an hour or so I was up there. But the astronauts, if they give them drugs, the thinking has been, well, you want them to adapt. So, you're really just delaying adaptation by giving them drugs, especially on a longer mission. So it's something they just have to tough through.
And there are many interesting studies. One of them was some bed studies, which makes sense, I guess, mm-hmm. when you think about it, because I'll have you describe it, which is just looking at what happens when people are, in a sense, I guess, not doing
weightless. Right. When you are weightless, or if you're, someone in a wheelchair, someone who's just bedridden, when you take all your weight off of your skeleton, your body starts to say, well, I guess we don't really need that, and starts breaking it down. And you have some, for a Mars mission, I heard one projection you might lose from a third to half of your bone density, which is that's a pretty frightening prospect. So there's these facilities called, there's one in Galveston, the UT Galveston Medical Center bed rest facility, where volunteers are paid to lie in bed in their PJs and surf the web and watch TV. And they're paid about, for the study I saw, about $17,000 for a 3 month. But the thing is, you don't get out of bed
for three months?
For anything, not even to, I mean, we're talking bedpan. Here we go again. So people think, well, they're going to pay me to lie in bed and I can do video games, and it sounds like they've died and gone to heaven. And then they find out about the bedpan. So it's actually, when you are bedridden, you're for the first week or so, your back is sore because you're the curvature of your spine kind of flattens, and there's a lot of stuff going on that is uncomfortable. They have to be careful about bed sores, and it's not an easy $17,000. People think that it is. Anyway, but they're studying countermeasures, like ways to deal with bone loss, muscle atrophy, the fluid redistribution, all kinds of things that happen when you're not walking.
And they call them terranauts, right?
These are as opposed
to astronauts,
yes.
Right? These people that are, in a sense, being
voyagers on Earth, yeah. Yeah, and sometimes the astronauts will come over because, Galveston is a quick drive from Johnson Space Center. So sometimes astronauts will come over and visit them. And for some people, it is a way to be part of the space program. This guy I spoke to, Leon, he was a bed rester, and he said, yeah, it's about as close to being an astronaut as I'm going to get.
Lying in bed for three months.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's funny because they tend to be people who are, don't have the kind of background that an astronaut, kind of the anti-astronauts.
You do write about sex in space, and I guess sex at zero gravity.
Yes.
One can imagine some of the challenges there.
Mating without the benefit of gravity. I mean, on the one hand, you think, whee, that would be fun. But gravity is your friend, I think, when it comes to sex. And I learned this not from talking to NASA, who really are not interested in having this conversation. I called up a number of marine biologists who study the mating habits of animals that mate while floating in water, the earless seals, otters, for instance. And they both of these individuals made it clear that it was a problem for the male to keep the female close. There was a lot of sort of grabbing hold, and the male otter actually grabs the female by the nose, and it's a really sort of a brutal process just to try to, you know, keep together, because you kind of push each other apart. Yeah. And I actually did speak to one astronaut about this, and I sort of commented on what the marine biologist had told me, and he said it's not that big deal, nothing that a roll of duct tape won't solve. Everything, duct tape is used for everything up there.
And that was my 2010 interview with Mary Roach, author of Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. And when we get back, we'll hear my recent interview with actresses Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk, stars of the new movie Mistress America. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Mistress America, the new film from director Noah Baumbach, opens in theaters across the country today. It's about a lonely college freshman named Tracy, played by Lola Kirk, who's befriended by an older woman, Brooke, played by Greta Gerwig. They're brought together because Tracy's mom is planning on marrying Brooke's dad. Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk joined me in the studio last month to discuss the film, their roles, and their lives as performers. Let's take a listen to my interview with Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk. Greta, how would you describe your character, Brooke?
Brooke is so many things. I mean, she's already kind of a performance in and of herself. She's kind of constantly acting and putting on a show for everyone around her. And then she has these moments of real vulnerability, which are quite touching and heartbreaking. But, she's a hustler. She's always got some deal going, and she kind of sounds like she's lying all the time, but then some of it turns out to be true. And, she's just, in a way, she's drawn from people that I've known, but also, we were very inspired by certain 80s movies of like Roseanne Arquette in After Hours, or Melanie Griffith in Something Wild.
You want us to like her as viewers?
You know, I mean, probably to our detriment, Noah and I never think about likability. That's not something we ever talk about. I think that the fact is we write characters that we love, and we don't love them because they're perfect. We love them because they're people, and they're flawed and they're complicated. And I think if you spend enough time looking at someone in all their gorgeous contradictions, you find a lot to love.
And she does talk a lot. Yes?
And she's such a motor mouth.
She is a motor mouth. And how about your character, Tracy?
Well, Tracy's kind of the polar opposite of Brooke, but I think that when she meets Brooke, she is empowered to become maybe more like herself. There's a line in the movie that she says Brooke was the kind of beautiful that Morris, I'm going to...
Yes, just butcher it.
I'm just going to butcher Greta Noah's wonderful writing. She had the kind of beauty that made you want to look more like yourself, not like her. So I think that there's something about... meeting this whirlwind of a person that just like makes Tracy grow up a little bit more.
And Tracy's an observer. I mean, she's watching.
Totally. Yeah. She wants to be a writer, and she is very inspired by Brooke to do that.
It's interesting because here you're playing an 18-year-old. You're a 30-year-old. I think I got that
yeah,
right.
That's right.
So these are sort of, you know, the end of adolescence, the sort of beginnings of adulthood.
Yeah.
How do you see, and your other, even Frances Ha was about this relationship between these two women. Mm. How do you see these two characters sort of in their stages in life, if I can put it that way?
Well, with Frances Ha, we really wanted to explore this long-term best friendship that is changing because these women's lives are changing, and they're kind of trying to find a new language to express the love they have for each other. And in this movie, we wanted to do you know, obviously a separated age-wise, but also this idea of instant family, that their parents are getting married. It's sort of a force beyond their control, and that they're thrown together and then the journey that they go on together. But I think people are constantly in the process of leaving behind one era and entering a new one. And I think Noah thinks this too. Noah Baumbach, the co-writer, director, this kind of the tracers of not letting go of the thing that was earlier. I find those really interesting because this is about production design in movies, but someone said to me that you can always tell a good production designer in terms of if it's a period piece, like if it takes place in the 60s. If it's 1963, not every car on the street is from 1963. You got cars from the 50s. It's like you're never living through a period that's solely that. And I think, you know, when you're 30, yes, you're 30, but also you're 25. Mm. Also, you're 18. Mm. You have tracers of the things that were before. And I think letting those things go and dealing with your life as it actually is and not how you imagined it is something that I'm very interested in, and it's a recurrent theme, I think.
Well, and I think that happens through life. I mean, even as when you get to be 50, sure, there's still part of you that is 7 years old.
Oh, yeah, forever. Yeah.
I was curious, too, about girl crushes. I mean, girls get crushes on other girls, and it's not necessarily sexual, but it's, in fact, it generally isn't. It's just that, and if it's an older girl, sort of feeling like, gosh, I'd really like to be like her.
Yeah.
Definitely. How do I do that?
I mean, I've had my fair share of that. I think that these people lead you towards your own identity or maybe you have to pretend to be a little bit like them for a while. But I think that what's so cool about this movie is that it explores a really nuanced kind of relationship between people, which is one that isn't, you know, it's not just romantic. It's not goal oriented. It's people being inspired by each other. Cause as much as Brooke, is cooler and is older, I think that she gets a good deal out of being worshipped by Tracy.
Indeed. Yes.
She loves it.
Yes, to put a fine point on it. There's a line where at one point, Tracy character says, I don't know if you're a Zen master or a psychopath.
Oh, Brooke says
I say that. I say that about Lola.
Okay.
Yeah, Tracy, I say, I don't know if you're a Zen master or a sociopath. And I think in some ways, I think it's the first. In some ways, the person who is Greta is more located in the character of Tracy in a lot of ways than I am Brooke. And it's almost like Brooke has this sense of, and then she says, the next thing she says is, I'm so glad you're on my side. And I think she knows that Tracy is more formidable than she presents. And what she doesn't know is that Tracy is kind of not on her side in some ways.
Yeah.
And, but I think, she has this inkling that Tracy just has more power underneath her. And of course Tracy does, but, I think it's also, I'm interested in young people, especially if you're 17 or 18. Noah and I talked a lot about the first time you realize you can hurt an adult is a really very strange experience because you sort of think of adults when you're young as these fixed things that are unable to be wounded in quite the same way that your peers are, children are. And then that you have around, you know, between 17 and 20, you'll do something bad to an adult that will make them cry and make them hurt. Mm. And it's something that you won't be able to take back. And then you'll suddenly realize your own power. And it's an important step, but it's also, it's like you are now an agent in the world and you have the ability to really wound other people. And I think that's such a vivid moment. I remember the first time I made an adult cry.
What did you do?
I won't talk about it.
I mean,
no,
it was really...
No, I do remember the first time I wounded someone who was older, and I thought that they didn't. I thought they were impenetrable. Like that
Did
they
you
had
mean
armor.
To, or just,
no, no, just, because I thought that they didn't. You know, I thought that they weren't woundable, and they were.
I just wanted to say that, but in the same way that Greta and Noah are crafting characters and not thinking about their likability and loving them in spite of that, I really do think that that's something that happens within the film, too, with Tracy when she writes the story.
Right.
And I think that the film is also a comment about writing and writing not being a victimless activity, as Greta said the other day, so eloquently.
Yeah.
Well, indeed. And Mistress America is the name of the story that
yes.
Tracy is writing, of, sort of based on
Brooke,
and without giving too much away, that's sort of becomes an issue between the two of them. But what's interesting to me is this Tracy character, she steals little things every now and then.
Yeah.
She's a little creepy.
She is a little creepy. I mean, you think she seems sweet and kind of innocent and kind of a little bit of a sort of her eyes opening to this adult world. But she's a little bit of a thief there.
Well, something that I love about Tracy is that she is, you know, all the things that you say that you hope the other person didn't hear, like the bad joke that you made or like the sentence you meant to finish but couldn't because you couldn't find the ending.
Mm.
Like Tracy is chock full of those things, those moments that she kind of would hope someone else would not see. And I think the stealing is part of that. And that we as an audience get to see her go through those moments where she said that incredibly awkward thing that Brooke, you know, didn't hear, but Brooke hears everything.
But, yeah. But I think the stealing, when you steal that airplane and then you steal the coin in the house, I think there's something that I've always liked in films, which, you know, really are as a writing art form, and we were very careful with the scripts, and we don't do any improvisation. The actors don't change the lines. We're pretty rigorous.
Word for word,
they're said. And because there is a limited amount of space, you've got, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours, that you have to, everything has to count towards something. But I love it in films that feel economical and they feel thought through, where there is a little trail that doesn't actually add up because life feels that way. And I think that the things that Tracy steals, nothing ever really comes of it. It's just we know she steals them.
No.
And I think it's almost like a secret between the character and the audience. And I love those moments in movies that you don't put those in a box.
There's a scene where I guess you first meet and you're coming down the stairs, and you know, sort of a grand entrance in really high heels.
Yeah,
I have to say,
I thought,
oh, she's going to fall.
No, yeah. Although we did write into the script that Brooke says, "Welcome to the Great White Way," and she does this hand gesture, and then she realizes halfway down the stairs that there's too many stairs for the amount of gesture that she's committed to. And I didn't even know if the TKTS steps were something we could shoot on or if that was the right. And it all turned out great, and we did shoot on them, and it worked.
Can I just say, I've seen you in several films now, I love the way you walk.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, you have a really, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how to do it, but it's a very signature kind of walk that you have.
Thank you.
It's from all those years fencing.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I don't know what it's from. But I did. I gave a line to someone in Frances Ha. A character says to her, "I knew it was you. That's your weird man walk."
Are you a fencer, though?
I fenced when I was younger pretty seriously. And I still do it for enjoyment and athletics.
And athletics as well.
Yeah.
Did you want to be an actor originally?
Originally, I just wanted to be close to people who made film or theater, and sort of any way I could. I didn't have a sense that it was something that I could do as a career. But then I did. I went to college in New York. I went to Barnard, and it was there that I had a great playwriting teachers, great acting teachers, and people said, "This is a job. You can do this. It's hard, yes, Ben. It's frustrating, but there's a path if you want." And so I think by the time I graduated from college, I knew that I was going to be part of this world somehow, and I didn't really care if I was doing it as a writer or an actor or as you know, I did like lighting and sound and stage management. I did sort of everything because I just wanted to be part of the world. But then I got rejected from playwriting graduate programs.
Did you really?
All of them.
Wow.
And then
hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine. I know. You know what? Actually, I have to say, I reread a play I had submitted. And, you know, I kind of expected to look at it and think, oh, well, I see why they rejected me. And I actually read it and I was like, this is pretty good. I can't believe I didn't get in. I was just sort of relentless about wanting to be part of it somehow. But it kind of some version of like, I never thought it was possible combined with I'm going to make it possible anyway, I can.
Well, good for you. How about for you, Lola? Was acting something you had your eye on as a younger person?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't really have a conception of myself wanting to do anything else, which is maybe a little sad. I mean, it's been part of the identity that I created for myself, was that I would be an actress in some way. But I think when I was younger, it was much more associated with the lure of, like, you know, fame and making everybody
Lola
who was ever mean to me.
Famous.
I wanted to be famous when I was 10. I mean, I wanted to be like a child star when I was 10. And then an actress that was friends with my mom was like, don't do this. And I was like, why? And she was like, go to school. And I was like, okay, and I did. And then
did you go to Barnard as well?
I actually went to Bard, which people weirdly confuse with Barnard all the time. But anyway, my pursuit of acting has definitely switched to a much more craft-oriented thing, and I really cherish the anonymity that I have and think it's a beautiful thing and think that it enables me to do my job a lot better because you can kind of switch between roles and be in your own life and experience it as a person and not, yeah.
I remember when
as a famous person.
Yeah. When I told my mom I wanted to be an actress at some point, I don't know, I was like 14 and she was like, do you really think you're as pretty as Julia Roberts?
Did she say that?
Yeah. And then I was like, no. And she was like, well, if you're not as pretty as her, you have to be as talented as Meryl Streep. And I was like, oh, no. I'll never make it. But my mom, I mean, I think I understand. There's an impulse to want to protect your kid from something that seems utterly impossible.
That was my interview with actors Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk. The pair star in the film Mistress America, which opens in theaters today. And that does it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Write us at radiotimes@whyy.org to tell us what you think of the show. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moskowain. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.